Hello, everyone. Welcome, nerds. Welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, as always, Kara Santa Maria. And I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsor of this week's episode. I'm so excited. We have a brand new sponsor today. This week's episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by Crunchyroll, the place for all of the anime that you love. And you can try it free for 30 days by visiting crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. That's crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. And just like always, I want to take a moment right here at the top of the show to thank all of you who support the podcast so that I can, you know, provide it for you week after week, 100% free to download. So first and foremost, I want to thank all of the amazing folks who went on patreon.com/talknerdy and pledged to support the show week after week. I want to thank Greg Rogers. I want to thank Rob Barcy, might be Barky, I apologize. I want to thank Brian Holden, also Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell. And I also want to thank the many, many, many of you who did kind of smaller micro donations, not even micro donations, that's not the right word, mini donations, because all of that really does go a long way to help. There's so many of you, and it's just, it warms my heart so much. I also want to switch gears over to PayPal for a minute and thank Megan Prout for your generous donation. Oh, also Michael S. Bigelow. Thank you guys so very much from the bottom of my heart. And if you are interested in helping to support the podcast, patreon.com/talknerdy, you can visit my page. You can see what it's all about. You can donate as little as like a dollar. Every amount helps, and then I get to continue to make new episodes for you guys and make sure that they're free for everybody to download. Also, one more quick thing before we get started. If you haven't visited my website before, carasantamaria.com, I ask that you go and you check it out and you see some of the cool work that I've been doing lately. My most recent project was with Vice Motherboard in kind of conjunction with General Electric. And if you go to carasantamaria.com/web, I think it is, or at least you look in the site nav and go to my web series, there'll be the first 5 episodes there under web. I'm really proud of them. I mentioned them last week. All 5 of them are out now. And I would love it if you would take a little look and tell me what you think. Also, don't forget to visit the Talk Nerdy store where you can purchase, you know, different wares. T-shirts and the whatnots. Also some beautiful mugs for sale and some cool leather goods. And that is it. That's the end of my shameless self-promotion. I hate doing it. I'm just not good at it. But I thank you guys for not fast-forwarding through it. That's very decent of you. All right. I am excited to welcome this week's guest to the show. He is a very interesting gentleman. His name is Matthew Fassiani. He's a PhD candidate in cognitive neuroscience at the University of South Carolina. And he is also a writer, a science communicator, a gender equality activist, and he's just an all-around interesting guy. So please welcome Matthew Fassiani. Matthew, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I'm really excited about this. So we met, I don't even know how long ago that was now, but it was at Skepticon. Was it at Skepticon? Yeah, so maybe in like September. I don't know. I mix up. I did Skepticon and Aposticon really close together.
Right. I think this one was in November.
November. Okay. So pretty late last year. And we were chatting and I think my interest was really piqued when you told me that you are, you know, finishing up your PhD and that you are working in this really interesting field of kind of the neuroscience of, I guess I would say, religion or religiosity or belief.
Yeah, that's what I'll be doing for my dissertation.
Yeah, that's crazy. I remember when I was, you know, when I was in graduate school and I was trying to figure out if I wanted to stick around and kind of where my head was at. And I was always interested in neuroscience and I was kind of doing a lot of work in neurogenesis and I was really interested in brain damage and recovery from brain damage. And then I started getting more into kind of atheist activism. And I remember thinking, man, it would be cool if there was a way to blend these interests. And it sounds like you've kind of managed to pull that off.
Yeah, I have. And it was interesting because I didn't start off in this field. I started off in neuroscience and neuroimaging. And just as a hobby, I started to give talks on the neuroscience of religion to different secular groups. And it kind of just grew into my academic interest, too. And that's what I'll be focusing on for the rest of my time in graduate school.
So, yeah, I mean, I met you at Skepticon. Skepticon is sort of, for people who don't know, I wouldn't call it an atheist conference, but it's definitely a skeptics conference. So a lot of the people there are atheists. Some of them are agnostic. Some of them are believers, but they're skeptical believers. I think there's kind of a thread of humanism and sort of like, I don't know, a lack of traditional religiosity in these kinds of conferences. So you're there to talk about belief and what's happening in the brain during that time. Does that inform your personal religion? Is that something that you're open to talk about?
Oh, sure. I can definitely talk about my own beliefs, but it is separate from what I study and what I believe, because I was an atheist before I even started to go and study this stuff for my graduate school career.
So, you know, when I'm looking at some of the different things that you've written for popular outlets, you talk a bit, you're like a kinder, gentler atheist than what I'm used to, because it seems like in many ways you really are advocating for the religious. And that almost seems, I don't know, it seems counterintuitive to me.
Right. No, I definitely get some flack on both sides from atheists and from the religious communities. So, and going back to skepticism, I think that's kind of the driving force of it all. I just kind of want to know what's true and what's accurate. And sometimes people on either side of the fence that are a little bit too strong tend to dislike what I have to say sometimes.
So when you're talking about what's true and what's accurate, but you personally don't have belief in any sort of higher power or in something that's, you know, supernatural.
Right, yeah, I'm definitely a strident atheist.
Yeah, so you're, you know, probably more, I don't know, I'm assuming, but more of a materialist or more of an evidence-based thinker as somebody who's finishing your PhD and who doesn't have that personal belief. So what is it about the belief that other people have and the links to their, you know, their brain and their behavior that interests you?
So the reason I'm interested in studying religion and belief systems, even though I personally don't hold to any of those sort of ideologies, is I kind of take a cognitive science perspective from it. So how do these high-level belief systems impact low-level cognitive processes? That's the interesting scientist, really nerdy kind of perspective I have on it. But obviously, I still have my own interest in religion. So for me, it was kind of a neat way that I could combine my interest in religion in the more abstract sense, but find a way to take it into the realm of cognitive neuroscience.
So before we get into, you know, what specifically you're studying, how you're studying it, and what some of your maybe preliminary findings have been, I want to know what you were doing beforehand, because it also sounds really interesting. You were looking at patterns or behaviors with regards to comic books?
Yeah, so that was another project I was working on. So to kind of backtrack into my academic history, I started off in graduate school doing neuroimaging methods, and specifically how we can identify different brain states from the patterns of neural activity. So we'll put someone in the fMRI scanner, we'll have them look at a picture, listen to a sound, and based off their brain activity alone, we can decode and understand what picture they're looking at, what sound they heard, and those kinds of things.
Gotcha. So before we get into detail with that, just let those people who are listening right now who maybe aren't aware of the different types of ways to image the brain, what's special about an fMRI?
Sure. So fMRI just measures real-time activity in the brain, and it's looking at blood flow specifically. So what regions of the brain are more active? We think that there's going to be more blood flowing towards them, and that's how we're able to see this 3D representation of neural activity.
And you can see it as the thing that you're measuring for is happening in real time. So it's not just over a long period of time, but like from this second to that second, where in the brain are we seeing a lot of kind of specific activity?
Right. So if they're looking at a picture and we know what time they were looking at that picture, we can see what activity was occurring at that specific time.
Gotcha. And so what did that have to do with comic books?
So what I found out was this specific area wasn't actually for me. It was very heavy in statistics and very removed from psychology that I was interested in. So I actually ended up switching academic advisors and went into a slightly different, more social neuroscience kind of area. And one of the first projects my new graduate advisor gave me was this comic book research, because she knew I was interested in gender and belief systems, and it just sort of happened from there.
And so what was it? What did it entail?
So it was a content analysis looking at themes of race and gender of maybe 100 comic books over 10 years, just counting specific representations of the characters. So how many characters were white? How many characters were men? How many were women? And of those characters, were they main characters? Were they central to the story? What was their, if they were rich, were they poor? How were they represented?
And so once you collect all of that data, what does that have to do with somebody in a scanner?
So this was actually totally outside any sort of neuroscience.
Really? Oh, interesting. So in this, you really were just trying to look at historical representations and say, look, like, you know, females and males are equally represented. Ha ha. I'm sure that's not what you found. you know, we see a lot of mixed ethnicities in comic books. Also, ha ha. I'm sure that's not what you found. What did you do? You remember? I mean, what did you tend to see were the trends?
Right. I mean, as you might guess, it was white men are overrepresented. They're always the characters with agency. Women and people of color are not represented. And it's unsurprising, but it's still an interesting way to kind of see how culture and how media can kind of reflect into our culture through the medium of comic books.
And so, I mean, before we get back to your neuroimaging studies with religion, which is, you know, kind of how I first met you was in that context and what I ultimately wanted to discuss here, I am really interested, as I'm looking through some of the work that you've done and some of the popular science writing that you've done, that you are very interested in these ideas of kind of ethnicity and more specifically gender equality. You know, it seems like you have a lot of writings as sort of a male advocate for feminism. Where did that start in you?
Sure. So that actually begins when I started getting more involved in volunteer work and even secular activism. I realized that there is still this big discrepancy in gender equality. And as a male, I kind of have a unique perspective and a unique role to kind of help balance that out. To get slightly more personal, I have had friends that have been sexually assaulted, and that really bothered me, and more so than that happening to them, that they blame themselves for it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of got back into thinking about victim blaming and this rape culture that I kind of wanted to combat. So I started volunteering at my local sexual trauma center, and after one of the first talks I gave, this person came up to me and thanked me for speaking to their group. And they're like, I've never heard a man talk about this subject before. And at that point, I realized that I have almost an obligation to speak out against sexual violence and try to talk to groups of men about this, because it's just something that doesn't happen very often.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that men aren't often involved in these groups and don't often feel that same obligation that you feel to try and, you know, use, as you said, which I think is an important point, their unique position to be able to, you know, advocate?
That's a tough question. And I actually just was at a conference last week in New York. It was an international conference on masculinities, and it was about engaging men and boys and gender equality. So that was the whole theme of the
Wow.
conference. So it was great. I got to meet a lot of my idols, Jackson Katz, Michael Kimmel. These guys have done just great work in the field, especially promoting this idea that men can be feminists and can promote gender equality. And we did talk about that. How do you relate to men? How do you get through to them? And I think it's obviously a very complicated question, and there's a lot of different reasons why specific men might not get as involved. I think one is they might not be aware of it. They might not be aware of these issues. They might not feel like it's a safe place for them to go into. They might not know how to be involved. And I think it does take other men talking to other men to get them more involved. We talked about the importance of speaking to men as peers. And I think that is why a lot of men haven't been involved, because they haven't had another guy to kind of talk to them on the same level.
Interesting. You know, I have a lot of listeners of the podcast and fans of some of the work that I do in TV, and I find that my Facebook community specifically, I find that there are a lot of kind of individuals that probably fit within that peer group that you're describing. I have a lot of cool guys who, and you know, it's predominantly men. Unfortunately, still at this point, that listen to podcasts, there's a really big gender disparity in podcast consumption. And so I've, when working with advertisers, presented my demographic information, which is upwards of 80% male listenership and 20% female listenership. And I've actually been told that I have a very female-friendly podcast because of that. That I have about half of my interview guests are male and about half are female. And having 20% female listenership is high listenership for women, which is very odd to me. I'm not sure what it is specific. I mean, I can't understand what it is specifically about a podcast that it's more male than female. But that being said, you know, I do have probably a disproportionate number of male listeners, but I do think that my male listeners are also probably, I shouldn't say disproportionately, but are heavily feministic, are very in tune and kind of aware of a lot of these issues and sort of unafraid to advocate for women, especially like when you talked about sexual violence, but also just for gender equality issues. You know, you remember Gamergate and all of these big things that were happening. I definitely had, I think most of my listeners were on a very specific side of that. I still have misogyny on my page, and I generally try to block it out and get rid of those people so that they can't post. But for the most part, I think I have that. And it makes me wonder, like, why there isn't more organization amongst them.
Right. I think as we talked about this conference, we mentioned how most men are actually going to be advocates for a lot of gender equality. Obviously, most men understand that sexual assault's wrong. It's just that I think there is a statistic that was 80% of men are generally for gender equality. They generally understand sexual assault is wrong, but they're afraid to speak up about it. And I think that's the real crux of it, is that there's a lot of people who know that these things are problematic, but they don't want to go out and get some of the flack that happens whenever you speak up about these controversial things, which makes a lot of sense.
And so, do you think that's more flack from misogynists or from individuals who aren't on that side, on the right side of history? Or do you think they actually also get flack from women who are like, what the fuck do you know about my struggles?
I think it's both, and it's tough because it really depends on context and how they approach it. I mean, if they go in as like, oh, I'm going to save these women as a male feminist, then, feminists are obviously not going to, women feminists are not going to appreciate
Of
that.
course.
So I think this complicated relationship of using their privilege for good to speak out, but also remember to take a step back and listen. And I think that's really the balance that needs to be achieved by male feminists.
Yeah, I mean, it is a complicated. There, this balance is very fragile because the idea, right? We're talking about it in just very kind of in a cavalier way, like using your privilege for good. Like we all know that there is male privilege that is still sweeping in our culture. And so the idea is trying to use your privilege to help undo your privilege, which is a very weird kind of issue, because ultimately the goal, right, with gender equity is that there is no male privilege anymore, that privilege is equivalent across the genders. So using your privilege to undo your privilege almost sounds a bit paradoxical.
Right. And it's tricky, because how do you give up some of your positions of power and some of your privilege and do that in a comfortable way, and, you know, be okay with other people perhaps having more. It's like they feel like they're losing something whenever it's just becoming more equal. And I think that's the real trick of it.
And do you
understanding
think... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much just saying that, you know, you're not losing anything. It's just people are having more opportunities.
Do you think that loss of something that feels so innate to so many men is what underpins kind of the heavy and violent and just very dark misogyny that we see kind of existing in different corners, especially of the internet?
So you think that, so just to make sure I understand your question,
mm-hmm.
Do you think we get these terrible, very strong misogyny on the internet because people are kind of afraid to let go of that remaining privilege?
Yeah, I mean, where does that come from? Where does this misogyny that we especially see kind of amplified on the internet come from?
Sure. I think, to me personally, from my experiences, I think it's a lot of fear. I think it comes from fear of women, fear of other men, fear of the unknown. And again, there's a lot of great guys out there. And whenever I speak to these groups of guys, you know, I was just speaking to a group of fraternity guys. And the first thing I go in there, as I say, is like, you know, I'm not coming in to attack you guys. Like, I understand a lot of you guys are great guys, and you understand that you want to you know, stop sexual violence and promote gender equality. But we can also have a role, a unique role, to speak to other men as peers. So going back to your question, I think on the internet it's particularly tricky because, as you know, you have that anonymity and you can just kind of say whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as why that even occurs on any level, I think it is people are afraid of either, I guess, so one example might be if someone's had some difficult troubles with women, then mm-hmm. they might be more likely to kind of lash out whenever they see, a woman that might be, they think, invading their territory, their space. Like someone speaking up about science, they might be more likely to attack someone, a woman that's speaking up about science, if they haven't had a lot of positive experiences with women in their past.
And do you think that, what does that even mean? They haven't had a lot of positive experiences with women. It's like, that's 50% of the population. So, I mean, do you think that oftentimes that comes down to, you know, a bad relationship, letting somebody in, being vulnerable to somebody, and then having their heart broken, you know, and that kind of will reflect on those trust issues?
Sure, I think so. And this is me speculating. Mm-hmm. I wish I had some data on this.
Well, also, how do you get data on something this complicated? You know, this is like
right.
almost the definition of an unscientific pursuit. Not that it's unscientific to attempt to pursue something like this, but there's just so many confounding variables.
Right. I think going back to it, so I know I've kind of just been spewing out a lot of my thoughts, but to go back to some science and some themes that I can kind of tackle with this.
Sure.
At this conference, we had sociologists and psychologists talk about this very issue. And one thing that kind of was a common theme was the problems of toxic masculinity and this rigid adherence to one's masculinity and how problematic that can be in relationships and also psychological health. There's so many studies looking at how if you feel like you always have to man up and you can't express your emotions, that's actually going to cause a host of psychological dysfunction.
Hmm.
And in regards to relating to other people, that's also going to be pretty problematic. So I think that's a big part of it, something we can actually study and look at is if you kind of want to cling to your masculinity in a very unhealthy way, then whenever you talk to people that might challenge your masculinity or your views on gender, then you might be more likely to lash out and dig your heels in and attack more.
Interesting, because you know, it's funny. I think about the way that we culturally try to combat some of these issues, because I think that our culture is progressing in such a way that there's, as you said before, across the board, probably if you survey most men, they would say that, like, you know, women should have equal rights and women probably shouldn't have to worry about getting raped. And, you know, these kinds of things are bad things and that we want to see more gender equity. I think that most people would generally agree with that. You're always going to have people who are like holdovers from, you know, centuries past who, like you said, are like desperately gripping to their male privilege. But for the most part, I think that we are progressing in a certain way. Sometimes maybe policy doesn't keep up, but the people have these views. But unfortunately, I think sometimes the way that we as a progressive society combat some of these issues is that we focus only on the girls. We focus on female empowerment, which is very important. Specifically, let's say with women in STEM, this is something that I advocate for all the time. And I go and I give talks about how there aren't enough girls in that leaky pipeline from the time we start, you know, in elementary school until, let's say, we're talking about tenured professorship, just the girls, the women, they just fall out. There's just not enough, and there's really no parity there. And what do we always focus on? Well, how can girls think about a new way of looking at themselves? How can we deal with stereotype threat? How can we deal with, you know, all these different ways that we interact with one another and that we interact with the boys? It's very rare, I think, that culturally we're at a place now where we talk about, you know, mom and dad, let's raise our boys to be more sensitive. Let's raise our boys to be more understanding and to be more equitable and to not worry about having to keep up this facade of I'm a man, so I don't have any emotions.
Right. And again, going back to this conference, this is like, if you would have been here, you would have had hopefully all these answers.
It would have been a field day.
But yeah, we talked about that, and because it was the name of the conference was Masculinities and How Do We Engage Men and Boys in Gender Equality. So it was how do we develop a healthy masculinity and address men's issues in a productive way? And you're right, we do need to talk about this more. And you know, on the Good Men Project, one of the places I write articles for, we talk about the conversation that no one else is having, we call it. And it's how to be a better man, how do we make men better too, and not just, obviously the Good Men Project is super pro-feminist and we're all for gender equality, but we also talk about developing healthy masculinity. And for me, how I would define that and how others might define it is having a healthy masculinity involves personal aptitude, doing whatever you want to do well, but not letting others define that for you. So if you want to go out and be a really good father or a really good cook or really good anything, that can be a healthy masculinity. And you're not letting, you know, commercials and media tell you how to man up and do whatever. And of course, masculine doesn't mean male too. It's, you know, women can embrace their masculinity as well. And I think that's also important to mention.
It's interesting because I think that there's some crossover there with this idea of rebranding what it means in many ways to be a nerd, what it means to be somebody who cares passionately about a subject, regardless of whether or not society says that that subject or that pursuit is favorable or cool, and taking ownership of who you are in finding your peer group, regardless of whether or not it's in the majority. So healthy masculinity, or even in many ways healthy femininity, it seems like it's not that different from embracing your inner nerd, from just really learning how to be you. And also, I think, training us as a society to promote that, to promote individual differences and the beauty and the offerings that individual people have, and kind of work against, which I think historically has always been a big positive in American culture, which is going against the grain and not being that centralized and not wanting, you know, not wanting to stay in the herd.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I really don't have much more to add than that. I think that was really well put.
Well, thanks, Matthew. So, you know, what I want to do now is, because, I mean, this is a fascinating topic. I feel like I could talk about it all day, and I may actually come back around to it a little bit. But what I think is a good idea now is to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of today's episode of Talk Nerdy. And then when we get back, we can jump into this really fascinating world of what is happening in the brain of somebody during belief and why does that even matter? So we'll take a quick break and we will be right back with Matthew Fassiani. All right, fans of anime, it is your special day. Here is a special announcement just for you. I am hooking you up with the world's largest lineup of anime on Crunchyroll, and you get it free for 30 days. Just go to crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. There you can watch as many as you want, anytime, anywhere. And guys, this is the best part, with absolutely no ads. Crunchyroll has top anime series like Naruto Shippuden, Attack on Titan, or Sword Art Online. And you can, this is really great, guys, you can watch the most current episodes of brand new shows. You've probably never even heard of them yet, unless you are a totally hardcore fan, in which case, good on you. But they're brand new shows like Can Cole, The Testament of Sister New Devil, Cute High, Earth Defense Club, Love, Military, Sakano, How to Raise a Boring Girlfriend, and so many more. They come straight from Japan. They're available literally as soon as an hour after premiering, and they're all professionally subtitled. You guys are going to absolutely love it. You can check out all of your favorite anime, as I said, completely ad-free. And you can watch it anytime, anywhere in beautiful 1080p HD quality, and you can see it on all of your devices, your iPhone, your Android, your tablet, or you can watch it on your big TV, not just your laptop, because you can use your Xbox, Apple TV, and a whole lot more. Crunchyroll is obsessed with anime. It was built by hardcore fans. They've got a massive selection of the most explosive, the highest level anime. Guys, this is your chance. If you want to binge on some awesome new anime, do it now. Don't wait. Go to crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. Again, guys, for a limited time, you can get an entire month free. So do it now. crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. I want to thank Crunchyroll for supporting the podcast, and I want to thank you guys for supporting by visiting that website, crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. We are back with Matthew Fassiani. You are a graduate level researcher, just working towards your PhD now. How far away are you from finishing that PhD?
So I'm in my fourth year, and
oh, that's great.
Dissertation soon. And you know, once a dissertation begins, it's a little hard to say. But
yeah, it's that's the fast track portion, but it's also like, who knows? That fast track could be a year, it could be 3 years, so.
Right, and yeah, it's ideally a year, you know, but if I had to give an educated guess, I'd say a year and a half, 2 years.
You're so close.
I know, so I can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
I'm so excited for you. You know, my very good friend Tegan Wall, who's a member of the Nerd Brigade, and people listening to the podcast are hopefully by this point well aware of the Nerd Brigade. It's a group of about 10 of us, big science communicators out here in LA who all care passionately about this subject and come from different backgrounds. But Tegan, just this past Friday, defended her thesis and is now Dr. Tegan Wall, just finished in neuroscience there at Caltech. And we're all very proud of her. So anyone listening, if you follow Tegan on Tay Interwebs on Twitter or whatever, make sure that you hit her up and say congrats, because it's a big milestone. A really big milestone.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, congratulations, Tegan. I'll give you a shout out here, too. That's
And so you are also well on your way. And in being on your way, you're at the stage now where, like you said, you're basically all but dissertation, which means that you are actively finishing up your research. Can I ask if I might be jumping ahead of myself a little bit, so maybe you don't have to go into detail quite yet, but do you have any preliminary findings that you'll be able to share with us about these really interesting research topics that you're investigating?
So yes and no. My written comprehensive exam, which is pretty much like a big background literature review of your dissertation, and I've been reading all of the recent research on the neuroscience of religiosity, and I can definitely talk about everything that's going on in that specific area and my own thoughts on where it might go. But as far as producing original research, I'll be doing that in the next couple months.
Then we can definitely talk about what it is you're planning on investigating and how you want to ask those questions.
Yeah, definitely.
But before that, yeah, I think that's actually important because you know what? I didn't really know that there was just a shitload of research out there. And maybe it's not really a shitload, but it's enough for you to dedicate a huge portion of your time and to work really hard to trying to be up to speed on what's happening in this area of study. I mean, it must be a pretty nascent area, right? It's very new.
Oh, sure. It's super new. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I started giving talks on, Your Brain on Religion is what I called it. And is synthesizing what we know about how religion impacts the brain. And there is a shitload of research on it already, even though it's
cool.
New. So it's so specific that we can even look at different aspects of religiosity, different aspects of, really specific parts of this area. So, I can talk about lots of different things. Whenever I give my talk on this, I cover the whole broad area, evolutionary psychology, social psychology, and I even end with neuroscience. But I can also talk about my own, where I'm going in my specific research too.
That's great, because now is the part where I kind of take my interviewer hat off, because I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, I don't even know what we know and what we don't know. I guess I can start with a pretty broad question, which is, what is happening in the brain of somebody when they are, and can we even define what it is? What does it mean when somebody is being religious? Is it like, do you study what's happening when they're praying? When they're, because going into a scanner, it's not like you can go to a sermon in a scanner. It's a giant machine and you have to go to the lab.
Right. So at the very beginning, as being a good scientist, I have to define my terms, right? So how do religiosity? For me personally, I define religiosity as a rigid adherence to any ideological position, especially one that provides a meaning system and a framework for understanding one's environment. So that could include, let's say, really rigid conservatism or liberalism even. I think that it doesn't have to be religion specific. It's that ideology that's very strong and there's strong convictions with it.
Gotcha. And so when we talk about, let's say, maybe an easy place to start in American society would be, very strident Christianity. Mm-hmm. It's a common theme in American culture. When we think of religiosity here in the States, we often think of Christianity because it is the overwhelming majority. And there's also a fair amount of political privilege that comes along with Christian religiosity. We definitely are a nation that in many ways favors Christian candidates. We still are not at a place where it's welcome for an outspoken atheist to run for office. They often have to hide that. It's almost the next step in, I would say, the next kind of civil rights mountain to climb, because you're probably more likely to be elected if you're openly gay now than if you're an open atheist, which is problematic. But I mean, and we can get to some of these other conversations about, as you said, maybe being politically passionate and that almost seeming like religiosity. Or I would love to talk a little bit about Islam and about this recent amazing article in The Atlantic, which I think was very telling, but also based on some of your writings makes me wonder how you felt about it. But before we even do that, maybe we can talk in the framework a little bit of Christianity, because I wouldn't be surprised if in doing your lit review, most of the research that was carried out in America, if that was what was looked upon.
Yeah, you're right. And we do look at predominantly Christianity in the studies I've seen, and it is an issue. It's a limitation. We also look at college students that are generally psychology majors. So of course we have a very limited sample. Basically, there's a couple ways that different researchers even define religion. So let's just say we're looking at Christianity, that religion we're going to look at.
Mm-hmm.
There's different orientations that we try to break this even further. So there's intrinsic, extrinsic, and quest orientation that are the three dominant orientations in the literature. And what they are is intrinsic is really living your religion, being it really personal for you. Extrinsic is you might go to church a lot, but it maybe isn't as personally relevant. And quest orientation is being very spiritual, seeking out other types of religions even, and being really open to things.
So when we think of like a fundamentalist movement in this country, that would be extrinsic.
It would actually be intrinsic. So
would it?
But all three of these orientations are going to have a lot of covariation.
Sure.
Yeah, the studies that I've seen have shown that a big overlap between fundamentalism and intrinsic. So you're believing, ardent religious conviction, God's word is God's word and that's it. And
I think, I think some of the issue is that the same way that we think of misogyny on the internet, sometimes we can get tripped up and we can think that that is like reflective of most men in this culture, which it's so not. I think we sometimes have the same issue when it comes to religiosity, is that we think of like the loudest, most fundamentalist, most kind of intertwined with politics and public policy as being representative, but really they're just very loud.
Right, exactly. I was just at a conference on Friday in D.C. It was about science and religion, having a dialogue between science and religion. And there were hundreds of religious scientists at this conference, even journalists. And they were saying, how the struggles they deal with talking to their religious communities about evolution. Like, they're a scientist, they understand evolution is correct, but there's a lot of people that share their faith that disagree with that. And kind of going back to what I was saying, those people might be less rigid in their belief system. They might be still Christian and a strong Christian even, but perhaps they're more open to other points of view. And I think that's something, again, that I have an issue with a lot of new atheists. And at the beginning, we were talking about how I kind of have a gentler approach to religion. And it's kind of because of my research, I researched that how complicated religion is and how multifaceted it is. So whenever I see new atheists say, religious people are stupid, they don't understand these things, I'm just like, well, first off, you're having this very sweeping generalization because there's so many different types of religious believers, and we need to really address that when we talk about the atheism and Christian and religion debate.
I think sometimes there's a bit of an unfortunate kind of synecdoche that occurs there, where people will kind of assume that an individual is representative of an organized movement. And I completely understand when you're talking to a new atheist, the emotional reaction that they have to organized movements within religion and some of the problems that they have with that. The problem is then we point to individuals and we say, look at this individual and look at their history or their track record because they were in the news, because, there were faith healers, whatever it is. And we say, look at this. This is symptomatic of this movement, which means that everybody is equally kind of responsible here. And I think that there's a big difference between looking at people and people's personal relationship with religion and looking at religion as an organization and having problems with the actual organization.
Right. That's a great point. And an issue with dealing with all that is that's a little bit more nuanced position. So coming back to the media and how we talk about things online, we have these provocative titles that, are going to drive people's thoughts on it, I think. And I think that's an issue with it, is just how we talk about it and the medium in which we talk about it.
Yeah, and like here on the podcast, we're lucky enough that we can have a nuanced conversation because we can sit here and talk for an hour. But when I go on the news, I get, 3 minutes, if that. And that becomes problematic because then people start to learn to speak in sound bites.
Yeah, and I think for something as super complicated as religion and how emotionally complicated it can be, I think we just have to at least say, you know, it's complicated, but, and then go on your soundbite. You know, try your best to really address the nuance. Or, you know, like if you go on CNN, you know, if I go on CNN someday and I talk about religion, I'll be like, you know, look at my blog post, you know, I talk about detail. I mean, it's tough. I'm not exactly sure how you get around that, but we really have to try our best to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue is that you try to be journalistically responsible. So knowing that you have to speak in sound bites, you try to make sure that your sound bites, as much as you want to make them compelling and you want to make people stop and listen, you also want to make sure that regardless, it's still true and it's still journalistically relevant. And hopefully what you're doing for those 3 minutes is you're capturing at least some portion of the audience that goes, oh, that's really interesting. I want to learn more. Because it's in that I want to learn more that all of the real kind of intellectual work begins. And I think that's what we do all the time as science communicators. I can't sit here and, you know, explain to you what a Higgs field is. I'm not qualified to do that. I'm not going to ever do it as well as a theoretical physicist who's dedicated their life to understanding these processes can do. But I can maybe spark an interest that makes you then want to buy, you know, Sean Carroll's newest book and read about it further. That's my role.
Yeah.
Or at least
I was just,
as I view it.
It's communication. I think that's a great parallel. You know, we have a couple minutes to pique interest and be accurate. And I think that's the real trick, is to talk about the subject at hand in an accurate manner, in an interesting manner, but don't go off with anything that is going to be misconstrued as something that's, you know, totally off from what you're trying to say. So
exactly. Don't just play to the headline.
Right. And I think, I mean, we're humans, so obviously it's going to be so incentive, you know, if we're selling a book, we might want to try to have a really sexy title that's where we run into issues. So that's something that I'd like to see more science communicators and more people talking about these issues just try to do a little bit better job with.
Well, I think a good example of that is I'm looking here at your blog right now, and in December, you wrote a listicle for Faith Street that said, you know, 5 things all atheists should know about religion. But then you followed up with a blog on your own website that basically said, one of the points was that religion is not the sole cause of violence, and you couldn't really go into it in the word restrictions that you had in that format, so you wanted to fully discuss it in more detail. And I think that that's a great way to do it, is you do something for another organization. They hire you to write something. They say, you know, whether it's paid or not, they say you get 500 words or you get 1,000 words, and that's what you have to stick with. But then on your own blog, you can go into detail about the things that matter to you. You're kind of self-published, you're self-edited, which is, I mean, that's what the podcast is for me. But speaking about this specific example, I would love to know what you did mean, because I think this is probably one of the number one areas of contention when it comes to the struggles with religion. And even religious people in this culture looking, for example, at Islam and saying, yeah, but that's not like my religion. That's a violent religion.
Sure. So I guess if I could, I would kind of go back to my own research, then I'll kind of go back to the broad levels too.
Of course.
To kind of try to tie it together. So basically what I'm looking at briefly is how religiosity impacts uncertainty processing and also anxiety of uncertainty. And the basically what I am looking at is how a rigid adherence to one's ideological position or religiosity can even affect very low-level cognitive processing of error detection and uncertainty. So if someone's super religious, they're going to have this almost buffer towards error detection and processing uncertainty. It's sort of like this protective measure that's built in because they have that framework for understanding their environment.
So when we say error detection and uncertainty, obviously those words have intrinsic meaning, but to me they kind of sound like science-y research words. What are you actually referring to?
Sure. So if you were to do even a basic task where it's just like, name this color, and you mess up and say the wrong color, your brain is going to detect an error. That's what I mean by error detection. Just basic, oh shit, I messed something up.
Yeah.
And there's a corresponding neural signature to the oh shit response. And we see that in people that are very religious, they actually have a reduced, I'll just keep saying, the oh shit response.
Gotcha. And I mean, does this relate to this idea of kind of cognitive dissonance in religion? You know, people who maybe are taught something that is not in keeping necessarily with scientific evidence, but holding on to it?
Yeah, I think that plays a role. Again, what I'm reading about in my comps is trying to bridge those two areas. And the last couple years, there's been really great research on connecting high-level cognitive dissonance and low-level error detection. Uh-oh, something's wrong, just even conceptually. And we see that there's common mechanisms for both of them. That's the coolest part, is whether it's something as complicated as my religious beliefs or something inconsistent versus, oh shit, I just hit the wrong button. Neurologically, there's so much overlap, and we see that these processes interact with each other. So if you have this complicated framework for understanding your environment with your religion, perhaps, then even on a low level, you kind of develop this skill to deal with processing error and uncertainty a little bit better than someone who doesn't.
Okay. So moving into this realm of kind of that point that you tried to make, which I think is a controversial point, but also I think there's a lot of merit to it, and I would love to hear your kind of take on it. What does all of this have to do with violence and religion?
Sure. So looking from a social psychology perspective, there's a lot of research that suggests people that live in very uncertain parts of the world or dealing with a lot of personal uncertainty are going to cling to some sort of ideological position to sort of balance out that uncertainty. So I think it's very important to note that whenever atheists say Islam is inherently violent and it causes problems, I think, and a lot of other social psychologists would agree, that it's not Islam, it's not any ideology that's really driving this. It's the people that are living in these really hostile positions are going to want to have some sort of strong religious conviction to cling to. So just like in the southeast of America, South Carolina, where I live, we have much more fervent believers because there's also a lot more inequality down here, and there's a lot more people of lower class that are struggling just to, you know, worry about their next meal. So that's the relationship, is whenever you're in some sort of uncertain, anxious position, you're going to seek out some sort of ideology to reduce that uncertainty and the anxiety from uncertainty.
And do you think that the reason that Islam is in these areas of the world, what is being clung to, is because that's the option that's available?
Right, because their governments might be corrupt. They might not have other ideologies that might be might serve the same role. So I think that's why Islam is what these people will adhere to so strongly. And there is bad things written in the Quran. There's bad things written in the Bible. But I think we have the luxury of interpreting those things in a better light whenever we're living in a part of the world that we don't have to worry about so many things. We're not under so much uncertainty and hostility.
So, I mean, there's this recent cover story in The Atlantic that a lot of people are talking about. I picked up a copy when I was traveling for work a couple weeks ago and read it on the plane. What ISIS really wants. And it got a huge amount of, you know, it just got a lot of people talking. It got a lot of backlash, but it also got a lot of people agreeing with it. Tons of comments online. And really one of the central themes that a lot of people had a hard time with was this idea that, I guess, that ISIS is actually quite Islamic. That really a lot of people try to say, oh no, this is a bastardization, this is an offshoot, this is a terrorist group, and this isn't what Islam really is about. But that fundamentally to what ISIS is doing here and their kind of their rallying behind this new caliphate is the idea that this is exactly what Islam is all about, and that they are probably the most fundamentalist and in many ways the most Islamic of all people who are Muslim. And a lot of people have a very hard time with that statement.
Yeah, and I'll preface this with saying, obviously I'm not a sociologist, and I'm taking this from a psychological lens. That's why I was kind of building up from that perspective. I still think it's unfair to paint any one religion as inherently violent. So going back to the article which you mentioned and kind of going full circle, that's why a religion alone doesn't cause violence, because there's all these other factors. There's going to be the psychology factors, sociology factors, and then there's the religious factors too. So even Reza Aslan will admit that religion does play a role in this, but you have to understand that it's a concoction of things, a concoction of factors that promote these sorts of violent behavior, not just with ISIS, but with any sort of behavior. And again, it doesn't have to be a religion. I mean, you can think about communism too, and the problems that came with that too.
Yeah, which was almost inherently atheistic.
Right.
Do you think, though, that the reason that you see this kind of new atheist movement and these more outspoken atheists specifically clinging to the religion aspect and not so much the inequality aspect or the historical context, is because those things are so complicated and those things are so hard to solve, but in the mind of an atheist, that they can say, yeah, just stop believing. If you just didn't believe in this, we wouldn't have this issue.
Right, and that's something I find very frustrating when atheists say that, because as we just talked about, communists were by and large atheists. So just remove one ideology and pretend that's going to, get rid of all your problems. There's still going to be people that will cling to something else or have need fulfilled with another ideology. So I almost think that new atheists will use ISIS position with Islam as kind of a way to kick religion again instead of getting at these more complicated issues. And it kind of relates even back to gender equality whenever atheists will critique all of the issues that religion will cause with gender equality. But atheists won't critique the gender equality even within their own atheist circle. So it's, are you really fighting for gender equality, or are you just trying to kick religion again?
Yeah, are you trying to find another excuse for saying that, oh, let's blame religion for this thing too? I mean, I guess it's interesting because I also get frustrated by the other side of the argument, the response that's so fervently, no, it has nothing to do with religion. It has everything to do with the disenfranchisement of the people, with the historical geopolitical struggles in these areas, with and all of these things are a huge, huge, I guess. I don't know that they're the. I don't know if they're. You could say that they're the foundation, but they're definitely an exacerbation of these problems. And I would even argue that they're way more than half of what contributes to, for example, strident and militant Islam would be looking at the people and where, what kind of a position are they in historically, and why are they clinging to this? But for people to say that religion has nothing to do with it. That if you took the religion out, it would be the exact same, I think is also a little bit less nuanced and a little too simplistic. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And like we mentioned with my article, my longer blog post, I kind of go into more about that and talking about the different factors that how these factors work within the religious framework to produce violence or produce the behavior we're interested in. So the framework, that's religion, is still having a big role in this, but there's also all those Muslims who don't go around doing these things. So obviously, it's not the only thing. And it's hard to put a percentage on it, how much of this is Muslims, how much of it is. But I think it's just super important to always stress how complicated it is and how it's both. Because you can't, as soon as you start saying, well, even it's mostly Islam, then you're just sort of trying to ignore the other parts of it that are very important.
That's true. And that's what I see when I watch these, you know, these talk shows, these more progressive talk shows, where you've got one person on one side of the table saying, no, it's religion. And if there was no Islam, we wouldn't have these issues and ISIS wouldn't exist. And then you have people on the other side saying, how can you paint Muslims with such a broad brush? It has nothing to do with religion, and it has everything to do with the geopolitical struggles in this area. And it's like, why are you both arguing so from like such opposite ends of the hall? You both agree ultimately on the fact that this is a problem and it's something that we should be addressing. Who cares what causes it? We do care what causes it, but why are you so firm in your position that it's one or the other when it's so obviously both?
Right. I mean, I totally agree with that. And it kind of goes back to what we were saying with the medium people have. You know, they want to have their sound bites, they want to sell their books, and they have perhaps their own agendas, you know? And that's working within the framework of only having a couple minutes to talk about this. Because our conversation, you know, is how long? And we're covering all these nuanced positions. And If we just tried to sell this, you know, and post this on CNN or something, they'd be like, you know, that's too long. It's too much stuff.
Oh, yeah, there's no way. Yeah. I mean, this is a struggle that I deal with all the time because I work in both media, right? So I work in... I podcast regularly, but this is definitely not my day job. This is not my main source of income by any stretch of the imagination. But it's something that I do because I love it. And it's something that I get support through advertising and through user support to be able to keep it going and functioning on its own. But what I do generally for a living is I work in television and web. And a lot of that is in journalism. A lot of it is in kind of edutainment. And I struggle with this because a big part of somebody who works in public media, a big part of your job is getting the next job. You know, at any given time, you might have a great job, but that job will always end and you need to already be working on the next thing. And a big part of that is partnering with production companies and pitching. It's actually going to the networks and saying, hey, I have this idea for a show that I think could be really compelling and be really interesting. And of course, my goal is to always elevate the conversation. I think back to what was mentioned last week or the week before on the podcast, that long story, but a publicist who I work with, her father recalled having a conversation with an important network executive who, I think it was like in the 60s even, said something along the lines of, if you feed people hamburger, they'll eat hamburger, but if you feed them filet mignon, they're going to eat filet mignon. And I think that's an important point, you know, when people argue, no, we're just giving the people what they want. No, you're just giving them the only option they have. And that's why we're all watching television shows about Alaskan gold diggers, you know, or gold rushers. And so that being said, I go into these meetings and it's tough. I want to say, let's do a cool long format show with a lot of nuanced conversation. And they're all like, boring.
Right. Yeah, it's so frustrating. And we see this happen in all sorts of things. And it's just like, you know, humans, we almost have a propensity to kind of want quick answers anyway, just to how our brains work, right? Mm-hmm. So what's attractive about having a long conversation if we're not personally invested in it? You know, probably not much. So in general, generally, people don't want to have, you know, these long, complicated discussions. So it's just something we have to try our best at. And, you know, I really appreciate that you try to elevate these conversations. It's all we can do is just do our best to fight it, given the circumstances and the context that we're working in.
But I definitely feel like, you know, I look at my listeners, I look at the people who stick with me week after week, and this is what they want. And I think that they do feel personally invested. And I think it's because it's important to talk about things that matter to people. And I think that, for example, ISIS, or even less than ISIS, but religiosity and gender equality and a lot of these issues matter to people because these things are things that they face every single day in their lives. And if we could try and get a more full understanding of it instead of just this superficial understanding, that's something that we walk away with. And that's a tool. That's like a new piece of information that we now have available in our toolkit that we can use to better ourselves. And, you know, I think a lot of people ultimately, they want to feel better after they watch something. They want to feel more armed with information. They don't want it to feel like they're in school.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be entertaining first.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think.
Yeah.
What I was going with is, yeah, no one's going to want to sit down and, you know, watch something really dense, you know, like someone
Yes.
You know, reading a neuroscience article, like a, you're just, how many people accept, you know, the couple neuroscientists are going to actually enjoy that. But if you, it's just so difficult to get that balance of, you know, interest and make it entertaining and relatable, but also accurate. And it's just a kind of a constant process that we need to work on.
It really is. And it's, I mean, you can speak to that. I can speak to that. And any of, you know, our friends who also work as science communicators can definitely speak to that. That is our daily challenge. And that's what we do every day and are trying to get better at each time we try. So we're getting close to the end. And I'm so excited that you were able to join me. I know we kind of went off on a tangent. I would love to know quickly before I get into my last two questions, I would love to know what your goals are now moving forward with your research. Is it really coming down to linking that the higher order cognitive dissonance with that error detection? Is that what you're looking to do?
That's going to be a big part of it, is going to be bridging that gap again, the high level religiosity, how does it relate to these basic uncertainty processing, just basic cognitive tasks, you know, uh-oh, I made something went wrong. But also, that's going to be the first part. Second part is going to be incorporating deception into it. And that's kind of the cooler area, which, see, I already think it's cool, but what happens when people have to lie about these deeply held beliefs? How does that impact all those things? So
that is really interesting. And that's definitely something that I think also, if you are a skeptic or if you are a kind of atheist, a humanist, a freethinker, all of those things, but definitely a skeptic, and you know, have studied or you've kept up with individuals like, for example, James Randi, like that's a really cool area of research, because that's what magicians do all the time, is this deception to sell an idea, or this deception to protect an idea. And we do it daily. Like, I think that we struggle with this idea of trying to both be open to change and learning, but also protect our previously held beliefs and make sure that we reinforce them, whether we're talking about religion or we're just talking about, you know, I don't know, the way we like to dress or the food we like to eat. There's always, it's just a constant struggle to maintain a sense of self.
Right, and that's another thing I mentioned, is how human it is to do this self-deception process. Like, we all self-deceive ourselves a little bit. And that's why another frustrating thing talking to atheists is, and they might say they're very rational and they're very skeptical. And they might be rational and skeptical, but they're also human beings. And being a human, you're going to have certain biases that you might not even be aware of. And that's something that we just have to try to combat as best we can. But that's kind of the direction going with my research and my dissertation. As far as beyond that, I can talk about that a little bit. I've kind of been getting more interested in science policy and science communication. So once I get my PhD, I might want to go for a faculty position, but I'm also open to trying to work with the government and communicate science to them about different bills that are going through Congress and the Senate, and try to use my scientific knowledge to promote human rights.
So important. To me, it's one of the most fundamentally important things that science communicators can do. And I kind of evangelize about this quite a bit, that even in my work, I've been getting away from doing as much straight science, even though I love science, and more getting into public policy and human rights, because I think that fundamentally underlying all of those issues is the scientific perspective. And that's something that we're missing, especially in American politics, is evidence-based thinking. We have politicians who love to write legislation that's based on their guts, that's based on feelings, and that's based on value systems. And it's less common that we actually stop and look at what works and look at history and learn from those things and make legislative decisions that utilize the scientific method. For some reason, that's just a very new and scary concept, I think, to a lot of people. But I would love to see it implemented more and more. And I think it's going to take people like you who are willing to go up on Capitol Hill and willing to, like, just pound the pavement and try and find ways to push back against the machine a little bit. So I thank you for even considering that as a career option. And I also thank you on behalf of my listeners who are either in graduate school, struggling with deciding whether or not they want to stay in graduate school, they want to start graduate school. Again, I'm always excited to show people that there are options outside of academia if you are academically trained. There are a lot of cool alternative careers out there.
Just to kind of briefly talk about that, I mean, I have a little bit of experience doing scientific testimony, and, you know, for me, I did it on an anti-abortion bill. It was fetuses feel pain at 20 weeks was the bill, and because they feel pain at 20 weeks, we want to ban abortions then. Well, I go in there, I testify, you know, the overwhelming scientific consensus is that they can't feel pain at 20 weeks. So passing this bill would be incorrect. And it was very frustrating for me because even though I very concisely cited all these studies and tried to lay out my case as best I could, my testimony had the same amount of weight as the doctors that testified after me that were just like, we all know fetuses feel pain and, you know, God would be frowning on us if he knew we were trying to pass or, you know, not pass this bill. And like, it's exactly what you're saying. We have this propensity to, especially the legislators in our country, to pass these bills more off their value systems and their party's value systems rather than, you know, what the scientists actually say. And I think that's all because it stems from a lack of overall scientific literacy. Like, what does it mean to, what does a scientific consensus mean? What does it mean when someone has all these citations versus someone just saying, well, I think this might be true?
And even understanding the difference between a research scientist and a medical doctor. They both say doctor. Medical doctors often don't have a lot of research experience. And so, yes, they can speak from their anecdotal experience with their patients. And some of them are more up to speed. Some of them do keep up with the literature and try to keep really current in their field. But if a medical doctor says, oh, we all know a fetus feels pain at 20 weeks, it's very different than a researcher who has actually taken the time to both do research specifically and corroborate it with other people's research, but also to do like extensive literary or literature reviews to understand globally what the consensus is. But I think people see both of those people as authorities that are equivalent, and that's problematic. I think there's also, you know, a lack of science literacy, but also a fear of scientists in this country. And that's something we have to work very hard to change. You know, there's a distrust of the quote unquote scientific machine because it gets associated in many ways with corporate interests that have nothing to do with science but can sometimes co-opt science. And it also is associated with just historical kind of representations, I think, of the mad scientist, of the nefarious scientist. And then, of course, we can have conversations about, you know, the Manhattan Project and about places where what we think of as scientific innovation can, quote-unquote, go terribly wrong. And knowing the difference between basic scientific innovation and utilization of that, knowing the difference between what science can do and what regulation needs to do and the roles that they have to play. I think all of those nuanced conversations, again, need to be had, and hopefully you will continue to have them. So before we break, Matthew, I want to ask you, or break, I guess, end the podcast. So sad. I want to ask you the same two questions that I ask all of my guests on the podcast. And I'll just let you go with them. So the first question is, you know, when you look to the future, what are you most concerned about? What keeps you up the most at night? And on the flip side of that, the second question is, what are you the most optimistic about?
Those are good questions. I think the most concerning part for me is actually kind of going back to the lack of scientific literacy, this lack of scientific communication, and just how this impacts policy and how this impacts human rights. We have politicians, you know, we all read the news and they say these really wacky things and they have these really unfortunate views about science, and they're the ones writing the laws. You know, they do all this stuff that's actually affecting people. And to me, that's so concerning because you have these legislators that are either willfully ignorant or they're ignorant about science, and it's directly harming people. So they have all this power, and it's causing all of these problems. And it's just sort of this whole system allows for that to keep happening. And, you know, we talked about some of the solutions to that, but it's a very uphill battle. So that's definitely something that's very concerning for me.
I am with you on that.
So I guess to kind of perhaps end on a more positive note, the optimistic side of me that is whenever I think about how many more people are involved in trying to fight that and embrace science for themselves, there are people that just want to learn for the sake of learning, and there are so many people that are interested in science and information and knowledge, and there's like this intrinsic drive towards that. So whenever I have a student that's really interested in psychology, or I'm talking about science to a group of people and I see how excited everyone is, that's what keeps me encouraged, is I see that there is a whole army of people that want to fight for skepticism, fight for human rights. Like these conferences I've been to, I go to these hundreds of people that are just fighting to make the world a better place. And that's super encouraging. You can think about all the awful things in the news and all the things we have to fight against, but it's also important to remember that there's a lot of people out there that are very unhappy with the way things are going, and they are actively trying to fight it. So that's a super encouraging thing, and I think that's going to continue to grow.
I love that. That's wonderful. I think that is a really encouraging point that I think a lot of people don't have access to. So it's wonderful to hear that from your kind of special perspective. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for taking the time on this lovely Sunday to sit down and chat with me remotely, of course, but still sitting down and chatting with me. And thank everybody else. Thank you, all of my wonderful listeners, for coming back week after week. I am really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.